It's just, can we just continue, you know, just a very brief review of Kehelas. And what I will take up now is in chapter 2, verse 11. And he also talks about the end of verse 10, where he says that he didn't hold himself back from anything, from all the gladness. This was where he was amassing wealth, planting vineyards and pools of water, and hiring maid servants and men servants, and he had plenty of wealth, and he was experimenting for the sake of humanity to educate on what actually provides satisfaction, happiness for a person. And he says that he did not hold back anything his eyes desired. And he didn't hold back his heart from trying out any type of enjoyments. What was he says at the end of that verse, and this was my portion in all of my labors. And you just put on your mute buttons if you can. I'm getting a lot of static. I'm just looking 1 second. Okay, let's let that go. I don't see a commentary on what it says. He said that his heart. He does say this similar in a different verse where he says what was actually the only satisfaction that seems to be derived. So it was the satisfaction with the labor. He says, "Ki libi sameach b'kolamai," my heart was satisfied with the toil, and this was actually my portion. So he says there was an aspect of the toil, the labor. And as he says this in another place also, that the actual working and what he achieved it seems to be in the moment. Doesn't talk about happiness from what he assumed, meaning the amassing of wealth and servants and physical objects. That was what he imagined. Or what the typical person actually would imagine. Of course, he was experimenting just to go through the emotional states in his own mind, and then he was able to look at himself. So he actually was the observer and also the observed at the same time. But he was able to do that. He had such objectivity that he can actually was going through the motions of pursuing what the typical man pursues. In terms of acquisition, wealth, fame, notoriety, possessions, all these things, he then looked at himself and examined how the reactions were psychologically in his own being. And he said that really the only satisfaction that he got was not all this imagined enjoyment, because it really didn't give him anything. So far, so he didn't have wealth, now he has wealth. He didn't have servants, now he has servants. But how does that affect me in terms of happiness? And they said that didn't do anything. The labor itself, there was something there. And you see, he says in the next verse, in 2:11, where he says that I turned to all my work that my hands did, all my labor that I toiled, and everything was a rus ruach, a vexation of the spirit. And there was no benefit under the sun. Meaning, in terms of under the sun, the physical, if I assess in my earthly existence, if this did anything for me, it didn't. There was nothing extra that I got here. I was imagining for something more to be here with all this wealth. That's what people do today. They imagine if they have all the wealth, this does something. It gives them some happiness. But the fact is, that's not where happiness comes from. It's a real blind spot that people really succumb to. And they think that they have all the wealth, that this is going to somehow change their attitude, their happiness in life, but that's not where happiness can come from. It's true that if a person has his needs taken care of, he's in a better state than if he doesn't, but let's say a person has his needs taken care of, he's got his food, he's got his clothing, he's got shelter. So everything else, he imagines there's going to be an additional satisfaction, but it's not there. And he said that he looked at this, he turned to it to see all of his work, and it was a vexation of spirit. And it was not something which really gave him satisfaction. But you see that the act of he looked, he turned to look at his wealth and to everything, all the works of his hands. So there, you also see that there's not just the examination, but it could be also suggesting that a person will try to seek satisfaction by, you know, looking at everything that he's got in the bank. Is that act of counting everything he has, or looking at it with a certain pride, what's that going to do? How long could a person do that? A person can't just focus on his possessions all day long, and the person's mind doesn't work that way. A person's mind is an active apparatus. It's an active faculty. And if a person is static and constantly reflects on one thing, he will become very disturbed. Not to even mention how unhappy he will be. You can't just think about one thing all day long. It's a possibility, and it's painful to do that. A person wants to explore. The mind wants to move forward. That's the way the mind is. It sees one thing, and even when it learns something new, it goes further. It explores further. And if you frustrate it and you don't allow it to do that, that creates the greatest pain. There's also the social need. You can't just be thinking. You have to be involved with other people. It's a very important thing. That's why a solitary confinement is the worst punishment, because people understand that the social is a very basic, fundamental need of a human being, to have interaction with others. But this thing alone, this amassing of the wealth and the maids and the servants and all this, this is not satisfying what's going to give the person happiness. Hello, can you put on your mute, please? I'm here, I hear somebody talking. Okay, thank you. He goes on at 12. And he says another point, that he said, I turn to use wisdom and frivolity and sichlus, foolishness. When he looked to see what aspect of the person is something that could provide the happiness. He was exploring the different faculties of the psyche. Should I just be, you know, happy-go-lucky? Is that type of approach going to help? So he says, Kima Adam, because what is man that he comes after the king, after he has already made him? So what is he saying by asking, what is man? Meaning there's a sense of accomplishment. There's a sense of ego, pride, that a person is looking to make a mark, to do something new, to achieve. But in reality, King Solomon says, what can you possibly do? And he quotes, Ibn Ezra quotes King David, where he talks about, and he says that this matter is referring to what? He's referring to King David when he said, when I look at your heavens and the sun, and the moon and the stars. So he says, what is man that you should remember him? I mean, man is nothing. Yeah, Joe, we're reading from Koheles. It's chapter 2. And we're reading verses 11 and 12. Right now, I'm just doing the Ibn Ezra on 12. Right, that's Ecclesiastes 2:12 in the Ibn Ezra. Okay, Joe. Okay. So you see that, well, what's the sentiment that Ibn Ezra is bringing up now? That King David said it very well, that God has created the most amazing things. What is man? So that's what King David's son here, King Solomon, is echoing, the same point. But he's touching on the aspect of where, again, the question all throughout the book is, where is the satisfaction coming from? Where is a person's satisfaction coming from? And where does he look for it? So, I mean, there's many faculties in man, many avenues that man assumes that he'll approach. And so that's what King Solomon was doing throughout the book, is experimenting and showing that they came up empty. But you see, the people are not like, why do people continue to go after these things then, if King Solomon said that they're empty and they don't satisfy? So people keep on doing it because they fool themselves. When they see they're dissatisfied, they don't want to face it. And perhaps it's because they have no other options in their mind. They haven't explored this. They haven't read the Koheles. So that what they do is they assume, I'll get the next trip will be even better. That'll give me some great fulfillment in life. Or the next bundle that I make, or the next dinner that I get such a great acclaim at, and fame and notoriety and honor, that'll really set things straight. That'll really give me the satisfaction I'm looking for in life. So that's what a person keeps fooling themselves. They don't come to the point, which King Solomon did very wisely, said, listen, I explored it. I explored the deepest recesses of a person's psyche, and I did it myself, and here's the results. It's not going to give you satisfaction. But he keeps going. He keeps on exploring. Like, for example, post-mortem. There's another area a person will look for satisfaction. And a lot of times he does that because when he gets frustrated throughout life. And so where else can I get happy? Well, maybe I'll leave over my wealth to somebody. But he talks about that too. He says, that's in 2:14, I believe. Just turn to the verse. Just two more verses. But you see that he noted in 2:13 that even though he explored all different parts of the psyche, whether it's an intelligent approach, or whether it's just frivolity or happiness and go lucky, he says, but hey, I saw, and this is 2:13, that there is a benefit to wisdom over foolishness as there's a benefit to light over darkness. So he uses a person's terminology, what a person is familiar with, in order to deliver his point that after experimenting with the different aspects of the human being, meaning himself, he tells you that wisdom is really the one aspect that's going to be a benefit to you. And he goes on, and how wisdom, the wise man, his eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. But then he goes back and then talks about, he echoes the sentiments of people. And you see how he does it very subtly. He says, but I know that one event is going to visit both. One event is going to visit both the wise man and the fool. So there, as we said many times, that he's echoing the sentiment that people have. Yeah, well, what good is it to be wise? Or why should I just be a fool and just be happy-go-lucky, forget the restrictions of Torah, and I'll just satisfy whatever emotions that I have. Because really, we're both going to have the same end. We're both going to die. Again, that's the typical person. that King Solomon is parroting. It's not his own view, of course. He's parroting what people feel in order to bring out their underlying feelings, and then when they read this, they'll say, yeah, I do feel that way. So he does this to elicit the real underlying feelings that people have, to get people to admit that they have these feelings, maybe to make it a little bit safe for them, you know, to come out of the closet with these views that they feel some more, you know, ashamed to say, but now that King Solomon says it, so they say, yeah, I feel that way too, but then he breaks it down. He only says it in order to tell, to give voice to a view that's really, you know, underlying a person's real feelings, what they feel about things. Like, why should I go after the Torah? Why should I be wise? Are we both going to die? So he brings that out in order that he could then address it. And that's what he says in the next verse. He says, and I said in my heart, like the event that happens to the fool, so also will happen to me. And therefore, why did I become wise? But then he says at the end of the verse, but I said in my heart that this is foolishness. Now, a person reading the verse might think that this is how you read it. Why did I become wise? The same event is going to happen to me that happens to the fool, so this is foolish to go after wisdom. That's how a typical person is going to read the verse, but that's not what it means. It means the King Solomon is saying what I said in my heart, meaning my real position as King Solomon, that this is a foolishness. To make this statement that it's worthless to follow wisdom because I'm going to die just like a fool. That's a foolish statement. Because there you're just saying that you only assess the value of a human being based on his earthly existence and nothing more. So since both the fool and the wise man die, so the wise man doesn't win. Nobody wins. They're both having the same exact end. The race ends in a dead tie. That's how a person typically will look at it, because that's a death ends everything. But that's a foolish statement, he says at the end. Then he moves on to the other, another big area. Another big area where people are looking for satisfaction. That I'll be remembered, I'll be famous, I'll go down in history. What does he say in 2:16? There's no remembrance to the wise man with the fool. Right? Now he echoes another thing that people might say. Well, I'm not going to have, nobody's going to remember me. So a person is looking, here the person is looking, this is a very big area, where people look for satisfaction, but they don't think for a moment. You're not going to be around after you pass away. So what type of satisfaction will you get by assuming that you'll be remembered? See, that's a foolish trick of the mind. But that shows you something. How it shows you how far a person is unhappy and how desperate they are to grab onto something that they would imagine will give them satisfaction. And not even now. The satisfaction is not even now. It's far off. And he goes through the different the phases of how the emotions work. He says at the end of 16 that everything is forgotten. And how can it be that the wise man will die with the fool? This is very bothersome. But this is still because he's talking to the state of mind of the person that's not knowledgeable. The person who thinks that life is completely limited to being under the sun. That's who he's speaking to here. And that's who he's echoing. And that's why he goes on and he says that I hated life. 17. Because the matter is evil upon me that is done under the sun. Everything is futile. But you see how he makes sure to put in under the sun. And we also said this is a major method that he used throughout the book, is whenever he says under the sun, means on earth, while you're still alive. Or just if you look at things just underneath the sun, and that's how you assess everything, with no consideration that the soul is eternal. So then, of course there will be evil results, and you're going to look at things as being unjust, unfair. How could the wicked person and the righteous person both die? I mean, where's the justice? Right? He's not talking about justice now. Now he's just talking about enjoyment, satisfaction, just benefit for the self. He hasn't touched on justice in this verse. And then he continues with the theme in 18, where he talks about that I hated the labor which I toiled under the sun. Again, under the sun. Because he's ridiculing only that type of a lifestyle where a person is assessing value based on his physical existence alone. So if that's all I've got, if that's the limit to my scope of analysis, so then of course a person is going to say, what use is it? And then he says that I'm going to leave everything to a person that'll be after me. Another thing which is bothersome. But then he concludes on that point, and he says in 19, and who knows if the person will be wise that'll come after me, or a fool that's going to rule over all of my work. I'm going to make a big inheritance, and then I'm going to toil, and I'm going to leave it to somebody else. Everything that I toiled over, everything that I spent my wisdom on to amass. But then he says, this too is futile. Again, when he says this is futile, it means this feeling is a futile thing. It's a worthless thing to worry about who you're leaving it to. If somebody's going to touch your money after you're gone, you're not here to be bothered by it. But a person doesn't look at that way. They're so attached to this world that they imagine even after they're gone, they're still aware of what's going on, that they're still going to be somehow related. It's still his money. He's looking at it as his money, even when he looks at himself as being a person who passed on. So you see, he's exposing the foolishness of how a person thinks. But it's out of the desperation to find satisfaction that a person goes to these extremes. Okay. Let me just stop here, see if there's any questions or comments before I go on. Okay. All right, now let's take up another point, which is in chapter 2, and it's 24 I have here in my notes. Let me go there, 224, so it's just a few verses. Yes, so we touched on this before, 224, where he says there is no real good for man other than that he should eat and drink and enjoy his soul in his labor. And this, he said, I see is from God. This is from God. For who will eat and who will feel, who will sense other than me? So what is this point over here? Take a look. There's no good for man other than he should eat and drink and see his soul good in his toil and his work and his labors. Other than this.
Well, that's not what my translation says. That's very interesting.
Okay. Yeah, Ibn Ezra brings that up. He says, there's no good. He didn't find any good in the except for the eating and the drinking. Except, he puts in the word except, that you, of these things. That's just a phraseology, a method of how the King Solomon wrote. I mean, see at the end of the verse, because this is from God. So therefore, that has to be a good. It's a good question. Why didn't they just write it openly?
No, I'm sorry. My translation says that it's a good, but it doesn't suggest it's the only good. You say there's no good, but my translation says, is it not good for a man that he eat and drink and show himself enjoyment in his soul? It doesn't suggest it's the only good, but that it is a good.
Well, he says only. That's what seems to be Ibn Ezra's explanation. It doesn't mean necessarily these two. I think it's a rule he's laying down, that where does satisfaction come from? He's already shown you what was painful. Like in the previous verse in 23. All his days he's in pain and anger. Even at night he can't sleep. I mean, a person who's going after... the typical person is chasing after the monetary or the physical. He's burdened by it. And that's what the rabbis say. With the increase in possessions comes increase in anxiety. You're worried more now about, well, there's more you can lose. And that's always a very big worry. A person starts to grow his business. He has to hire more people. He has to get a bigger place. And is more invested. And now he has to get larger accounts to pay for that. And now with one big account goes, now he's stuck with an overhead that is just unbearable. He can't even survive for a week. So with increased obligations and possessions and responsibilities comes increased anxiety. And Joe is saying, is it a sense of satisfaction from his accomplishment? Yes, I would agree with that. Meaning Joe is not talking about verse 24, where he says that the only good is that the person should eat and drink and see himself good in his work. Yes, but I think there's more to it. I think the satisfaction and the accomplishment is part of it, but he's trying to show you what's the real satisfaction, what's the real enjoyment that a person gets. So it's the here and the now, meaning in the process, in the actual act. There's a sense of when a person is actually in the process of going after something and a new project comes in, there's an excitement, he's working on it, he feels good, and now he's providing for himself. That's a real satisfaction. That solves a real, that caters to a real need in the person. And the eating and the drinking is the same thing. He's trying to show you the most basic needs is what gives the person the real, true satisfaction. He's hungry, he eats. He's thirsty, he drinks. There's a sense that he's having the here and the now. It's not a protracted or imagined type of a fantasy where the person has, for example, planning a trip or things that are going to happen in the future. Or most of the fantasies or most of the enjoyments that the people have, it's imagined. It's imagined. They build up these great things. I'm going to build that house. But then there's 2.5 years that they still have to live with their son-in-law and daughter in a cramped, small location until the house is built. So now they're going through stress. Then when they finally get in, this wasn't built properly. So they imagined satisfaction, first of all, is not immediate. So you're not enjoying, you're not in the state of satisfaction all that time. And then when it finally comes to, it can't meet the fantasy that you painted. Because fantasies, by definition, are pristine. They're flawless. Nobody fantasizes about getting a new car and then getting it dented right away or a scratch right away. Nobody imagines that because that's not how the imagination works. Imaginations produce perfect things that are not bound by time. And it's something which you assume you'll get the same satisfaction a year later as you had on the first day. But that's ignoring the fact that there's novelty that wears off, there are problems that come up, and so on. So what does it mean here that there's no real good for man except that he should eat and drink, and he should see his soul good in his labor? Meaning, in the moment, the activity is something which satisfies the person. A person naturally feels good when he's in a state of accomplishing. It's not afterwards when he looks in the bank and so on, then the worries start coming up again. And the eating and the drinking is also a sampling of where a person is actually enjoying in the moment. That's enjoyment means that it's now, it's happening. It's not something which is protracted. It's not something which is off, pushed off a couple of years until it happens. And you see what he says? For who will eat and who will sense aside from me? What is he adding in 25? This is 225. He's trying to explain why 24 is true. So take a look. So Sforno says that in this manner, when he's the one that's actually enjoying it, he's doing the eating and the drinking. When he's eating it, it's his senses that are being satisfied. Then lo ya amalo lezulasi klo. So he says, my work in that case was then only, it was exclusively for me. So now there was some satisfaction. This was not work that he now stored up and now had to worry about, who am I going to leave this to when I die? Meaning when something that the person does, he fully enjoys and consumes. So he's showing you that those other aggravations that he talked about earlier are irrelevant. They don't apply in this case. Because when I do the work and I'm enjoying it, all these other concerns aren't there. So according to Sforno, this is reflecting back on the earlier concerns about, I'm going to make all this money, that I toiled with my energy and with my intelligence, and so now I'm going to leave it to somebody else. So that type of a work includes pain. The satisfaction is greatly obscured, it's mitigated by the concerns that a person has. But if a person's on the right level and he makes more than he really needs for the moment, he's not going to have that. If he's really on the right level, he doesn't get involved in concerns about things that are foolish. If he's on the right level, if he's intelligent. But he knows that when he passes away, the money's not his anymore. So he doesn't worry about it now. He doesn't worry about something which is not going to be a pain. But it's a foolish person that has these assumptions that creates such a amount of aggravation for him. Let's just see if Ibn Ezra Rashi says something on this. You see what the King Solomon is doing is trying to bring out, where are some real enjoyments? Where can you look for the satisfaction? It could be a very simple thing. You join a friend for a meal, and you enjoy the person's company, you enjoy the food after a day of work, and a glass of wine, and a discussion, that can give the person the greatest satisfaction. That's really him, right there. He's in the moment. But working towards things that are you may not ever enjoy, and putting away so much, and building great empires, and all of this is, you're not in the moment. Right now, all you're involved is in a lot of toil to keep your big machine fueled properly, but it's not offsetting you with enjoyment because the amount of energy and labor and worries that you have invested. When do you get a chance to stop and to actually smell the roses of it? 1 week a year, 2 weeks a year, is that... is that really commensurate? Is that really what a person is looking for? Okay. So that's an important thing. I mean, I think that's an important lesson, that in terms of a sense of where the satisfaction will come from, it has to do with what's real, what's now, what's not diluted by other concerns. Okay. All right, then he goes into the next chapter, which he talks about there's a time and place for everything. And that's also very important. We don't have to go through every single one. But he gives many examples, of course, because our primary thing is about time to cry, a time to dance, a time for mourning, a time for laughter, a time for war, a time for peace. Why is he saying all this about there being a time for this and a time for that? And we'll end on this. So the reason why he says there's a time for something, because again, whatever, you know, an intelligent person speaks, certainly a prophet, King Solomon, and you know, all the words were divinely inspired. So the Torah as well, everything, you know, that God told Moses, what Moses said himself, that were on such a high level that God said, put this in the Torah. So it's trying to address either to correct a false notion or give you an idea that you might not have known otherwise. Here, I believe it's to correct a false notion. So King Solomon says that there's a time for this and a time for that. He's speaking to the notion that people have that they feel certain things, it's always the time for this. Meaning, so the people do have this feeling that something is always right. Certain attitudes are always the proper attitude. Like people who, like the pro-peace activists. So sometimes peace is not good. You know, an enemy is coming to bomb the United States. You better not try to, you know, the missiles in the air right now. You don't talk peace. You counterattack. You get out your ballistic missiles and you knock those out of the air. You go to war. But that is not how people think in many areas of life. And it's a very common, it's a very base emotion. And where it comes from is from the desire for security. A person wants to have a security in life that things are going to go well. Everybody has that. The only problem is, how do you go about it? How do you go about achieving security? And can you have it absolute? Of course, a person would love that. King Solomon is saying no. He's saying that there's no one attitude that always is going to be right. You can now rest your head on that and have this 100% security in that emotion, in that attitude. He's saying that's exactly what he's addressing over here, is the need of security that people have, and the way they try to satisfy that is to look for something, some attitude, some thing, some object, whatever it is they're looking for. But here he's addressing attitudes, he's saying people are looking for that to say, oh, here's one that I know I can always rest upon, that this will give me a certain amount of security. He's telling you no. Even peace is not something which you could always, you know, hang your hat on. Sometimes you can't have peace. Sometimes you can't be dancing and laughing. There's a time to be sad. There's a time to mourn. There's a time to destroy. There's a time to build. Whatever it is, don't think there's just one attitude that's going to satisfy you at all times. Because depending on the events, the situation that you're in life, the people that you're with, the needs that you have of that month, of that week, you have to act a certain way. The only one thing which is constant, and he already said it, is wisdom. That you should be guided by an intelligent approach. You examine your current state of affairs. You assess what the needs are, what's important, and of course, knowing what's important is an analysis in itself, and that's what this book is about. What's important in terms of satisfaction, happiness? So, over years, a person, if he continues to learn, and to understand and analyze, and then he abandons what he sees ultimately is false, and he replaces that with what he sees now is true. A person constantly matures his approach. Every future decision, every subsequent move will be that much wiser, and it will yield, you know, that much of a better result for him. So if a person wants to hang his hat on one thing, it's going to be on his approach, an intelligent approach where he's constantly driving to learn more and to increase his understanding and to push away the ego, accept where his errors are, and recalculate, rethink, and use the best intelligence and get advice. That's the one thing a person should, that it is constant, because that's how the world operates. The world is functioning by a design. And unless you understand that design that God embedded throughout the world, so then you'll be in conflict at every turn. But if a person analyzes and he studies the world and he sees how things operate and what's good to approach and what's something which is damaging so he should avoid, and he constantly learns, so then that's the one thing a person should be constantly doing. But don't ever think that to gain that security that it's this thing or that thing. Use intelligence and you pray. You follow the path of the patriarchs. They did everything they could in their own power, their ingenuity, their muscular abilities, intelligence, their planning, and they realized that they had to pray too, because there's so many variables that are just unknown and out of their hands. So they didn't rely on miracles. They did whatever they could. They realized that's how God made us. He gave us senses and intelligence because he wants you to engage the world in that fashion, using your intelligence, using your senses. Of course, you admit that you don't know everything, so you pray to God for the assistance where you can't do it yourself. So that's the approach is what is constant. That a person can have security in. And that's what King David said many times. He said that, God, you're my rock. You're my salvation. That was his security. A rock meaning something which is immovable, constant. That's why he referred to God as a rock, meaning you're the one thing which I know is always there and always good and just. That I can have security in. Even when he was chased by all his enemies, he had the right attitude. Right, but in terms of looking at things in life, happiness, sadness, this and that, it's wrong to ever say one thing is good all the time, because things change in a person's life. Okay. All right, any questions? Okay. Okay, so for next week, look over, you know, further, see if there's anything, any points that you have questions on, we'll keep moving forward. Again, we're just going to do a very quick review, because we did spend, you know, came out to be a few years on this, and we did go through it in depth, so just so we touch on the main points as we wrap it up, so that's what we'll continue next week. All right, so if there's anything that you want to take up as you look through it, let me know. All right, in the meantime, have a good week, and we'll pick up same time next week, all right?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay,
have a good week, everybody.
Okay, buddy.
Thank you.